Land Use. It is 9 a.m. August 2nd. Good morning, committee. We welcome Representative Greenlick, who is a guest of the committee this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we have full representation on the committee. We will begin by opening a work session on an LC draft that we'll be taking a look at, and so we'll get going on that right away. Committee, we're going to look at two issues for possible committee measures. One called the Metro New Look Program, which we're going to look at first, and then although we're not going to, we will try to get a vote on that today to move it out as a committee bill. The other one we're looking at as a committee bill will be the regionalization of LCDC, but we will not have a vote or try to move it in October. Which brings up another quick thing, is that we have one meeting left after today. We're looking at the first week in October, and we have the option as to have it here in Salem or anywhere else in the state of Oregon. So if any committee member wishes to make any recommendations as to where to have that final land use meeting outside of the Capitol, Patrick or the chair would be more than happy to entertain your thoughts. So keep that in mind as we go on. That doesn't have to be done today, but sometime after this month we need to decide as to where we will meet. Okay, I will ask Randy Tucker to come forward and begin the presentation on the Metro New Look Program. Randy, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. Metro, as you know, is the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area, which our jurisdictional area includes 25 cities and the urban portions of Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. And we deal with a range of issues, including relevant to you today, land use planning. I wanted to just briefly present this legislative concept to you, and then our council president, David Bragdon, will give you a broader presentation about the New Look effort that we have underway right now. And just to clarify, the legislative concept that we're looking at is only a small piece, sort of a prerequisite in some ways, for the New Look. It is not the whole thing by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it just changes one word in the statutes.
Now, we don't want to get this confused with the Big Look.
That's correct. In fact, a couple of years ago, before there was the Big Look, Metro was starting to talk about doing something called the Big Look, but graciously stepped aside and relinquished that name to the state. And in fact, I think Big Look is more appropriate for what the state's doing, and New Look may be more appropriate for what Metro is doing anyway. So, it is fortuitous that the two processes are going on simultaneously. Just very briefly, I want to explain this legislative concept to you, and it's pretty easy to understand when you look at the concept itself. I wanted to give you a little bit of background. Metro is the only jurisdiction in the state that is required to reevaluate its urban growth boundary every 5 years. And, you know, by reevaluate, that involves a lot of analysis. When you're dealing with a complex urban region like the Portland metropolitan area, it costs us millions of dollars to do the work that underlies the decision-making process that the council undertakes to expand the urban growth boundary. It is a process that was put in place, I think, about 10 years ago at the request of the Home Builders Association, and we have faithfully complied with it. Metro has faithfully complied with it, but it is it's eaten us up. It takes an awful lot of money, energy, and time for, I think many people are now agreeing, limited public benefit. The council last expanded the urban growth boundary in a large scale in 2002, though there have been some subsequent expansions to sort of complete that process for industrial purposes in 2004, and then responding to a remand from LCDC in 2005. We've learned, and as David will elaborate a little bit later, that you can spend an awful lot of time expanding the urban growth boundary and focusing on the line itself, when really what the region wants is to focus on the land that's been brought into the urban growth boundary and to get that land ready to go, under development, and to make great communities out of it. So over time, I think the original advocates for this this five-year cycle have begun to agree that moving the line is not the whole story, and that we really need to focus our resources elsewhere, or at least shift the focus of resources somewhat. Last session, we came to the legislature with a bill that did the identical thing, extended the cycle, the Metro Urban Growth Boundary Expansion cycle, from 5 years to 7 years. At the time, the home builders specifically were amenable to that under the condition that we also created some hard deadlines for getting the land that has already been brought into the urban growth boundary planned and, you know, ready for permitting, basically, ready for construction. We agreed to include some language in the bill that would have created those hard deadlines. That ran up against some opposition from the local governments of the region, who expressed concern chiefly about an unfunded mandate being imposed upon them, being told to plan areas that are not in their jurisdiction without any money associated with the requirement. Between a rock and a hard place, thought, well, let's step back. Let's come up with a better solution. And so the Metro Council, with the leadership of Councillor Brian Newman and our Chief Operating Officer Michael Jordan, convened a process, collaborative process, that included public and private interests in the Metro area, that resulted in the establishment of a temporary construction excise tax in the region that was implemented with the support of the development community. And it's a tax that applies to them. It's temporary. It will expire as soon as the council, as the tax, has raised enough money to pay for the planning in the areas that have already been brought into the urban growth boundary. It's estimated that that'll take about 3 years. And by passing this temporary tax with the support of the taxed entities, we think we've gone a long way toward addressing the concerns that held up this legislation last session. The development community sees that there's movement on getting the areas planned that have been brought into the boundary. The local governments have now got a source of money to pay for the planning that is necessary. And we're hopeful that we can move forward next session now, focusing on the extension of the five-year cycle. Just FYI, I did speak to the current lobbyists for the Metro home builders and the lobbyists for the state home builders, who you well know well, John Chandler. Both of them are perfectly amenable to having this bill introduced at this time. And, you know, we've been in, you know, consistent contact with them about this concept over many years and recently as well. So I hope there won't be any objections to at least introducing the bill today as a committee bill. Before David comes up, I just wanted to say you've got some materials that apply to his presentation, not to mine. An article from the Portland Tribune that appeared a couple of weeks ago that's a good overview of what we're dealing with. Not every single fact is perfectly right, but it basically tells you the story. And a set of issue papers that detail the problems we're facing, the challenges we face, and the questions we're trying to answer in this new look process. But at that point, unless you have questions about the legislative concept, that's all I need to say.
Any questions from the committee of Mr. Tucker? Seeing none, Randy, why don't you stay there while David comes up?
I've got to operate the PowerPoint, and it's very technical, let me tell you.
We're very impressed. And the absence of John Chandler means that, you know, he's not interested.
He's out of town.
Yeah. Oh, even better.
I spoke to him last Thursday.
Okay. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Garrard, committee members. I'm David Bragdon. I'm president of the Metro Council. And I'm here to update you on some of our activities as we're looking at planning in our region. Just want to stipulate as well, I'm a member of the Senate Bill 82 committee that was created in the last session, looking at the state system. And so I'm not here representing that body, but certainly our chair, former Senator Mike Thorne, is always willing to come and meet with you at any time, either individually or as a group. And I know he's extended that to the Speaker and the Senate President. I'm here to talk about our region, being president of our council. First and before talking a little bit about where we're going in the future, I wanted to just refresh our memories about where we've come from in the region. We've been working since the mid-90s on a concept called the 2040 concept. At that point, 2040 was 50 years out into the future, and the population growth was forecast to reach a certain point by the year 2040. And underlying that 2040 concept was the basic principle of trying to grow up rather than growing out the way so many other metropolitan areas in the United States have done, and to try to concentrate development in particular centers, historic town centers in around the region, as well as new areas as they're brought into the urban growth boundary. The purpose of that concept and trying to concentrate growth in that way would be more efficient use of infrastructure dollars and tax dollars, easier to serve the protection of agriculture outside of the urban area, to protect the existing investment in existing neighborhoods and maintaining stable neighborhoods in existing areas, as well as a more efficient transportation network and the clean air that results from that. Over the 10 years that that concept has been in play, there have been a lot of successes around the region. We've had population growth without extending the way other American metropolitan areas have. We've managed to maintain cleaner air than most areas. We have redeveloped and maintained the investment in a lot of existing neighborhoods around the region, whether it's downtown Gresham or downtown Hillsborough or portions of the city of Portland, that are having revivals rather than decaying the way often would be the case in other parts of the United States. We also know that the public supports this concept as well. We've done some public opinion research, which has been shared with the committee, with regard to public attitudes toward the urban growth boundary and trying to maintain that. The public supports that concept. At the same time, we recognize there are a lot of things that we need to be doing better and probably doing differently. And I think as we've run up against some of the rubs in the system, that will help to shape our agenda before you over the next couple of sessions. One of the things that we've experienced is Randy just alluded to, which is so much of our system has been all about the urban growth boundary, and being on that five-year cycle means that we're continually squabbling among ourselves and with our local government partners, as well as the various interests, about a relative handful of acres around the edge of the urban growth boundary, rather than focusing on trying to strengthen the communities that we already have. Another reason that we need to do better at that is that urban growth boundary amendments are getting harder and harder, both in terms of financial, the ability to service new areas, but also in terms of citizen attitudes and as well as the views of the local governments around the edge of our region. Representative Greenlick has certainly experienced that with regard to some urban growth boundary expansions in his particular district, which cause a high degree of agitation. Finally, the other reason that we need to be taking a new look at things and doing things differently is that the financial systems pertaining to growth management really have changed and are broken, frankly. Over the last 40 or 50 years, as we accommodated population growth, so much of the infrastructure that was used to accommodate that was either federally funded or was advanced by local governments on the basis that they were going to be paid back for it by property tax receipts. The area as our area grew by a million people from the mid-60s up to the current point, a lot of our highway network, for example, the majority of it, the interstate system paid for 90 cents on the dollar of federal money. That's something that no longer exists, for example. A lot of the expansion areas, as the area grew over the last 40 years, whether it's the high-tech areas around Hillsborough or residential areas elsewhere, a lot of those costs were fronted by local governments in a pre-Measure 5, Measure 47, Measure 50 environment. Those financial systems aren't working anymore, and so actually building out the concept that we have is going to require new ones. It's as if we had we have a blueprint, but we don't have the contractor on board to actually do it. The major reason that we're taking a new look at things, and the reason that we think we need to change the way we're doing business, though, is simply the driver of population growth. We're about 2 million people in our region right now, including our friends across the river in Clark County, Washington. And by 2020 or 25, it will be about 3 million. So population growth is not only occurring, but it's occurring faster than was anticipated in the 1990s. And if we just continue doing business the way we're doing under the current state law, that million population growth over the next 20 or 25 years would lead to very large UGB expansions, probably UGB expansions in places where it doesn't make sense. We'd probably under state law be expanding the urban growth boundary in places where either the market or the public doesn't want it, yet we would be prohibited from doing it in other places where the market or the public might say makes more sense. And we would also be disconnecting those urban growth boundary expansions about where people live from where they work, putting a big strain on the transportation network as people have to live and work farther and further apart. A million more people coming to our area really is a transformative impact. As I mentioned, we accommodated over a million people coming to our region from the mid-60s to today over about a 40-year period. And in doing that, we had financial mechanisms that were the product of the times, primarily the federal financing mechanisms on highways and transit, but also the federal mechanisms that related to sewer and water provision under revenue sharing that was very much a factor in the 1970s and the 1980s. Accommodating a million people in the future without those types of federal support for highways and water systems and sewer systems, and without the ability of local governments to extend services in the way that they did in the past, is going to be a big challenge. And that's one of the major things that we're looking at. The components of this new look really are threefold. The first is the one I've alluded to most, and it's really all about money. It's about how we're going to invest in the public infrastructure to keep our communities working, both economically, but also in terms of quality life. How are we going to fund the transportation? How are we going to fund water, sewer, schools, and the other public services that are required, not just to accommodate the people who are being born and coming here, but to bolster our existing communities? So that's going to be a major issue. How do we do that in a way that supports the community's objectives? We did it in a certain way based on the federal formulas and tools of the 1950s. As those tools go away, we need to be coming up with new ones. Second major thing that we're looking at is the shape of our region itself, and that really relates to this contentious urban growth boundary process that we're responsible for, but it also relates to our relationships with our neighbors, whether it's Yamhill County or whether it's the city of North Plains or city of Sandy, and our relationships with the agriculture industry. We've been driven on a UGB basis on a particular hierarchy drawn up in the 1970s. It doesn't necessarily relate to the profitability of agriculture, but it relates to how soils were classified at that time 30 years ago. We're undertaking a study with the agriculture industry and with the Department of Agriculture to look at the value of that these days and to come up with something that may make more sense, both for the viability of agriculture, but also for the orderly provision of urban services. The third component of our new look is a regional transportation plan. Historically, we've done those, as other areas have, based on a paradigm of federal funding that no longer exists. And so this time we're starting with the resources we have rather than the resources that we hoped we might have. What all that might mean for you and what we will be talking with you about in the next session and probably into the session after the next session, it's a bit premature for me to say because we're launching this just in the last several months, and it's also got to be a group effort. Most of these things are not in the hands of the seven of us on the Metro Council. Some of them are matters of state law. So many of them are matters of implementation for our friends in local government. And so we're working with all the cities in our region to come up with a mutual agenda that we can come to you with, that we can all support as a region. We're also enlisting the various interests in our area to come up with a combined agenda so that we can come to you on a united basis Randy just referred to the work we've done with the home builders and the associated general contractors and local governments on this construction excise tax and the plan. That's the template we're going to be using from now on, is that sort of collaborative one, so that you're not having iron out fights, intramural fights among us here in the state capitol. Instead, you'd be hearing ideally from us on a combined basis. Another implication of what we're talking about is probably going to be as much about or more about investment and finance and governance as it is about regulation. Our system has been highly regulatory up to this point. The urban growth boundary is exclusively a regulatory tool, divorced from those financial mechanisms that really make an area either come to life or not. Third implication of what we'd be coming to you about will be about state law specifically pertaining to urban growth boundaries. Again, we're early in the stage of that, and one of the reasons we're asking for the breathing time with that extension is to be able to continue work with the local cities and with the agriculture industry, as well as our neighbors, Yamhill County and Columbia County and others, to figure out where we need to be going with that urban growth boundary process, rather than just stay on a treadmill every 5 years. Finally, we'll also be formulating discussion with you about those financial tools, including the transportation ones that really do affect land use, including the governance structures. We have increasing numbers of people in our region who are not living in cities but are using urban services that are being cross-subsidized by somebody else. In conclusion, we're facing a perfect storm in our region of 1 million people being born and coming there, at the same time that our abilities to finance and pay for the services to accommodate them are broken because of the changes at the federal level and because of the statewide ballot measures. So with that, we need to look at new ways of doing things, and that's exactly what we're doing. We recognize our area is unique, but we think other parts of the state also have their particular challenges. Certainly the Medford area, growing very rapidly, is going to be running into some of these similar sorts of things, the Bend area similarly. And so we appreciate the chance to learn about what's happening in those areas and see if there are commonalities in terms of the state system, in terms of the regionalization you're going to be talking about later, where we could have some fruitful dialogue. I appreciate the chance to be here this morning and would be happy to respond to any questions that you have.
Thank you for a very complete report. Any questions from the committee of Mr. Bragg? Representative Sumner.
Briefly, sir, would you explain to us the temporary development tax? Who's going to pay it? What's the average per unit cost?
Certainly. Representative Sumner, Chair Garrard, happy to respond to that, because that was, I think, one of those unresolved things that you saw in the last session. And we took it upon ourselves to go back, well, let's figure this out among sort of our family, so to speak, within our region. The situation we were faced with is we had expanded the urban growth boundary and complied with state law and been upheld for it and brought land into the urban growth boundary. And the development industry looked at that and said, well, that's all very well and good, but we can't do anything with this until it's actually developable. And it can't be developed unless people know where the sewer lines are going to go, where the roads and streets are going to go. Meantime, the local governments who have to serve these areas were saying, well, we don't have the money to do that, and if we continue down the path we're going, it's at, like Metro is telling them, well, you have to reduce your police budget or your library hours or something to increase your planning budget. It's an unfunded mandate. And I feel very strongly, and I think our council feels very strongly, that problem solving today means getting these different interests in the room together and trying to figure it out, rather than telling the cities what to do or trying to make excuses to the development industry. So we worked for about 10 months, and our chief operating officer, Mike Jordan, really, really spearheaded this. And what happened to the development industry came to the table and said, we are willing to pay a construction excise tax if we are assured that the proceeds from that are going to make land developable for us to continue our business. And the local government said, well, we're willing to do the work as long as there's a source for the funds. And so we were kind of the broker of this. It's a 3-year period. It'll raise about $6 million. The answer to your question on a permit, I believe probably the average is about $150 on a permit. And in terms of that, it's a 1.12% of permit value. And that was part of the whole negotiation with the home builders and the contractors. It's sunsetted so that after 3 years, or if the money accumulates faster, it goes away. And it's dedicated in our code to go to the purposes that the industry and the local government said it's going to go to. So, you know, we see that as a practical measure that all the parties could agree to, because they're clear on where the money's going. And the other part is that, you know, it doesn't pass through our hands at all. We were the honest broker on this. It actually gets, well, it does pass through us on sort of on an accounting basis, but it gets collected at the local permit counter.
Okay.
So there's nothing, the contractor or the home builder doesn't deal with us at all. They just continue to deal with the city that they were, the permit counter they were already dealing with. And then we have intergovernment agreements with all of those permit counters. And then we have outgoing intergovernmental agreements with those who receive the funds.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add a couple details to the, you know, to what the provisions of this thing are. Remodeling projects are exempted. Basically, anything under $100,000 is exempted. And also the very, very large projects, the $10 million and above, are exempted as well. Or not, they're not exempted, but that's the cap on the value that would be subject to the tax. So the for a house that has a $250,000 construction value, permit value, the tax would be $300, 0.12%. And again, it sunsets as soon as we've raised the $6 million, which we anticipate will occur in 3 years.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Barr.
Thank you. I had two questions. One you just answered on remodeling and that. I appreciate it. The other one is more for my education, and I should have asked this to you before. I realized that I should know this. But what on the Metropolitan Service District, how is it defined so that it's specific to the Portland area, I assume, what we're dealing with here?
You mean statutorily?
Yes.
There is a chapter of the statutes, Chapter 268, mm-hmm. which deals specifically with Metropolitan Service Districts, and there's only one Metropolitan Service District in the state, and that's Metro. But I don't know, we'd have to get one of our attorneys to answer more specifically as to whether there's some provision for creation of other Metropolitan Service Districts. Right now, there's only one, and I believe the legislative concept that you've received today specifically refers to Metropolitan Service Districts, so it's only us that it would apply to.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
Well, it does. I was just wondering if there was a definition or whether you're just mentioned, I mean, you're mentioned in it as the only one.
I actually don't know the answer. Do you know?
Well, in terms of the urban growth boundary cycle, the five-year cycle, I know it does apply only to us, and sometimes the statutes refer to metropolitan areas of a certain size, and we're the only one that qualifies, or sometimes they refer to us by name, and I'm not sure which one this is.
Okay.
But I know we're the only one that this requirement applies to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the lobbyist for the special districts is in the back of the room. He might actually know the answer, but I can get you the answer later on.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Would the lobbyists like to come forward and answer the question?
I don't know if he knows the answer, but
we think it's
by population.
So that's Mr. Ross suggests it might be population.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bragdon, appreciate your coming this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there...
I'm sorry. I want to just mention one more thing. The polling that was alluded to earlier is on Metro's website. And so if you want, if anyone in the room, we didn't bring oodles of copies, but if anyone in the room is interested in seeing that, it's on our website. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the room that opposes LC 1155 that wishes to speak?
My only comment on it, Mr. Chair, is that I think it should be 10 years instead of 7 years. And I think 7 years is a kind of compromise in this, and I think even 7 years would be a stretch for Metro. I don't know whether Randy has a comment on that, but I think 10 years would be a better number. I mean, I'm in favor of expanding it from 5.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, very briefly, we did introduce the bill originally last session with a 10-year cycle in it. I think that's all open to discussion and negotiation. There's one critical element I forgot to mention about it, however, and that is the relationship to the Big Look. The Big Look's going on right now, as you know, and it will not be completed by the end of 2007. End of 2007 is when our next 5-year cycle would end. And so we would be required to expand the urban growth boundary at the end of 2007. That seems less than wise, given that the rules governing urban growth boundary expansions are on the table right now with the Big Look Committee, and that'll be under discussion over the next couple of years. Everything could change, and given the expense and controversy and acrimony of urban growth boundary expansions right now, and the fact that we have a bunch of land in the boundary right now that we're working, as you've just heard, to get developable that's not yet online, it certainly seems like we'd want to take a time out and not have to expand the urban growth boundary before the Big Look issues its report to the legislature in 2009. But in terms of going beyond, in terms of going beyond 7 years, that is certainly something that we're willing to discuss. In my conversation with John Chandler last week, he suggested that that might also be, worthwhile conversation. He had some other ideas about things he might want to see in the bill that actually had nothing to do with Metro. So you'll hear more about this, obviously. Right now, we'd appreciate just having the bill in the process so the discussions can continue.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
Chair would look for a motion. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that LC 1155 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Esquivel has moved that LC 1155 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection from the committee? Seeing none, then without objection, LC 1155 is adopted. And we thank the committee. And we'll move on to, and we'll close the work session on the LC 1155 and open a work session on Senate Bill 887. Informational meeting, I'm sorry. And ask Linda Ludwig to come forward. Patrick, would you like to give a quick background as we prepare for Ms. Ludwig?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to. Senate Bill 887, which was passed during the 2005 session, required that the committee assigned to deal with land use issues during the interim appoint a work group to look into the large issue of annexation. It listed several statutes that the work group was to consider, made some suggestions and directions as to who should be appointed to the work group, and at our meeting that we held in April in Tigard, the committee appointed a work group of 12 members, and that work group has met 4 times, and at its last meeting finalized the report that you are going to be handed out right now.
Perhaps Representative Jensen would like to have a rocking chair.
It would be appreciated, Mr. Chair. If you could arrange that, we'd be very indebted to you.
Maybe find you a lazy boy.
That would even be better.
Oh, rock and chair.
Mr. Tucker, I thought it was interesting that you find various members of this committee from representing rural Oregon making a vote on Metro. I think that's good that we learn, the two learn each other, and I think this is a very positive step in that regard. So, Ms. Ludwig, you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, Deputy Legislative Director from the League of Oregon Cities, very delighted to be in front of you today. Could I ask, Mr. Chair, if your permission, we do have four other members of the work group that are here, if we could have them come up to the dais, and I'd like to speak first and offer the opportunity for any of the other members to speak that would like to afterwards.
Certainly. The committee, the chair has not had a preview of this report, so we're looking at it for the first time all together. I have to tell you, Linda, I'm impressed. 117 pages. I'm very impressed.
In just four meetings.
In four, yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Jess? Are we expected to have this read by the time that she has completed her?
All but yourself, Representative.
Thank you.
No, actually, committee, we will take no action today on this report. All right, Linda, you may proceed.
First of all, I'd just very like to give my gracious thanks to the chair and members of the Interim House Land Use Committee to move forward with this work group that was appointed by Senate Bill 887 and allow us to have the conversations, discussions, and meetings that we have had over the course of the last 2 months. I'd also like to thank each and every single one of the members that was appointed to the committee for their work as well. And those people are Steve Bryant, representing the League of Oregon Cities, Dennis Mulvihill, representing Washington County, Art Schlack, the Association of Oregon Counties, Kelly Ross, Special Districts Association of Oregon, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association, Harlan Levy, Oregon Association of Realtors, Elon Hassan, 1000 Friends of Oregon, Mark Nelson, representing business interests, Lisa Hamilton Trek, Friends of Bull Mountain, Kashmira McVeigh, Friends of Bull Mountain, Richard Reed, Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexation, and Mr. Brennan, as committee staff, just did a fabulous job, as well as Don Phillips from Representative Crummell's office was there with us through the process. Again, I just want to say thank you to all the work group members for those that participated and that for those that could not. This work could not have been done without each and every single one of those folks on the committee. When we began this process, I anticipated that there would be few, if any, issues or items that this committee could agree upon, given its historical diverse opinions about annexation. However, I'm very pleased to come forward to you today and say that there were actually 27 items of consensus that the committee agreed upon and would like to forward to your committee for consideration. I think the time that we spent was very beneficial. It's my opinion that this issue, annexation, is much too large and has quite a few connections that are vital to other aspects of our community, how we govern, how we urbanize, how we provide necessary services, and how we provide for economic stimulus in each of our communities. The discussion that we had was necessary, and that continues to be the case. These issues are too important for one stakeholder group to win on and another to lose on. We need to continue to have these discussions so that our understanding can evolve of the best ways to urbanize in the state and that stakeholders and citizens alike can move to something closer to consensus so that we can have statewide requirements that are practicable and a way of doing business that benefits us all, citizens, property owners, developers, business, local and state government alike. My intention was that the committee, as facilitating the efforts of this committee and chairing the work group, that the committee be thoroughly aware of the individual contentious annexation issues that we're seeing occurring across the state. However, we needed to review annexation as a whole, how it affects all communities in all parts of the state, and not just the ones that are in the newspaper today, tomorrow, and yesterday. There is something in this report that I penned for everyone to love, and there is something for everyone to dislike, and I wouldn't have felt that I had done an adequate job if that hadn't been the, if that wasn't the case. So, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to walk you very, very briefly through the report and concentrate a bit on the executive summary and those 27 items of consensus.
Fine.
Can we take a look at the table of contents so that you just have a sense of what's here for you? The report was intended to alert you as the committee to the items that we discussed, the items that there was consensus on, and to give the committee members a comprehensive background piece on annexation that can be utilized as an educational document and as a reference document as the legislative process moves forward and each and every single one of our committee members moves forward with this issue from today on. We see early on in the report the executive summary and chapters dealing with land use planning and annexation, the identification of underlying urbanization issues, moving towards the political climate of annexation issues in Oregon, how annexation affects economic vitality and local government finance, the general arguments we see both in Oregon and across the nation for and against annexation, the issues, the collective issues, and there were many more than 27 that were identified by the work group, an overview of annexation methodologies and the process that we have currently in Oregon that includes annexation agreements and a referendum process, a historical piece about Senate Bill 122, that was passed in 1993 that deals with urban service agreements and annexation, a background about the significant legal issues and case law that we currently have in Oregon, and a brief look of annexation elsewhere in the nation, how we stack up, how other states do this, and some of the methodologies, I believe there are 8 that are described in the report that are used by other states. It's just kind of a look-see. The appendix include the bill that we were directed by, Senate Bill 887, copies of the summaries of the meetings that we had that were authored by Mr. Brennan, list of the communications that we received in the work group, and the materials that we, the extensive materials that we reviewed during the course of our meetings, and a complete copy of the statutes that relate to annexation. So if I could get you to move to page 5, the executive summary, and I'd like to just briefly walk through some of these points here. Oregon is very unique and challenging in the way we choose to urbanize, and it includes laws and requirements that don't always complement each other. And I'm sure that anyone that's been involved in land use issues in the past recognize that. Oftentimes, those laws and requirements actually conflict. And I've given you some examples here. State law requires high levels of land conservation, yet there are also state policies that require the encouragement of economic development in our communities. We have a state planning program that requires local governments to spend vast amounts of money planning for urban growth, but we also have a majority of citizens that have given historical directives that they don't particularly want to pay for it by increasing taxes or growing governments. Collectively, Oregonians appear to support the values of efficient urban development and preservation of resource lands, but those values, as we see here in the legislative process, quickly come into conflict when applied to individual properties, especially in the fringes between existing city limits and long-planned urban growth boundaries. We see those conflicts ending up in appeals, and we see them ending up in our courts. that further slow the expansion of city boundaries, the urbanization process, and add costs. This is historically what we've seen. Looking at annexation, likely the largest conflict is a statewide requirement that cities are required to plan, adopt, and maintain a 20-year supply of land that's established and mapped inside the boundaries of an urban growth boundary for purposes, again, for purposes of accommodating for future growth at urban levels. At the same time, there are state laws that allow the disruption of annexation of territory within the AGB to be served and urbanized in order to meet that very same 20-year land supply requirement, and oftentimes the city's long-term objectives for economic vitality. So we have this push-pull. We have one set of requirements that say inside the UGB is where we're going to urbanize at urban levels of development. Yet, indeed, we have another set of rules and requirements that govern how we go forward and annex and bring services to those areas to develop at urban levels. One of the biggest issues and items I think that the committee wanted to bring forward for your recognition is that annexation and urbanization's issues are different in different parts of the state. That was very, very persuasive. The city of Burns doesn't have the same concerns as the city of Beaverton or Corvallis or Sisters when they go to annex territory in their city. What are the factors that make them different? And we did find a list here of factors that made them different and play to a large degree in how annexation attempts are perceived in different communities. Those factors are existing development patterns. The annexation of areas that have already developed at urban levels are generally more difficult to annex. The amount of service district and the provision of essential services in the unincorporated area is another factor that comes into play when communities are looking at annexation. The timeliness and amount of direct citizen involvement there has been in developing the short and long-term planning objectives of local governments, usually the city, and whether or not that citizen involvement has what the work group has coined as being front-loaded. Are they involved at the beginning of the process? A very, very important issue. Whether or not a community has developed and maintained a shared community vision that promotes economic vitality and opportunities for growth, and it is mirrored and supported by the citizens in their community. The existence of long-established unincorporated residential communities who view themselves as distinct from the adjacent city, despite many years of inclusion in that city's planned urban expansion area, and the development pressures on largely vacant parcels of unincorporated lands that are relatively easy to annex and service, but which ultimately surround other unincorporated residential property owners who prefer the status quo or where they are in terms of being unincorporated. Now, again, you will see a long litany list of all the issues that were discussed. And that list, and I do want to highlight this, starts on page, it is actually in table form on page 27, and I've called this the entire kitchen sink or the laundry list of issues. And don't confuse that list of issues, which we had conflicting viewpoints on, with the list of issues, the 27 consensus items that we see began on page 8. We categorize these consensus issues or items in several different categories. General issues, increased sustainable citizen opportunities, economic vitality, efficiencies, urban service agreements and annexation plan agreements, sustainability, and others. Those were the general labels or tags that we tried to put and aggregate these items for your perusal. In terms of the general issues, I've already touched a little bit on some of these. The first one, and one of the biggest, is that there's important underlying issues for urbanization processes that affect annexation processes significantly. And there's explanation of each of these issues there that begin on page 8. Unless you have questions, I'm not going to go through the explanation. Annexation processes, bullet number 2, do not integrate well with the other requirements such as UGB implementation and the 20-year land supply. I touched on that already. Annexation issues are not all the same in all regions or all parts of the state. The provision of services is not the same, how that's accomplished in all regions or all parts of the state. And interestingly enough, upon research, there's no general policy directive and statute for annexation, except a very brief one that's put into the Boundary Commission statutes that don't reflect policy directives for all types of annexation. There is a general need to simplify the annexation procedures that are used in Oregon. Again, this is under general issues and one that the committee came to consensus on. In terms of increased sustainable citizen opportunities, we did come up with some suggestions that are more detailed that we'd like the committee to consider. A property owner notification by uniform disclosure statement in the deeds and earnest money agreements at property sale, if not in the city limits but within the UGB. This would be a notification to potential property buyers at sale, that they wouldn't be potential, actually they would be property buyers, that their property is indeed inside the urban growth boundary. We find that many, many people that buy property do not understand or realize that they, where they are located, potentially has future plans for levels of development at urban levels. Alongside with that, committee thought that a single website that citizens can go to receive information about specific properties, including zoning, UGB status, would be very beneficial. Citizens, developers, governmental units, all in one. There are some websites by individual county assessors, and some of those are aggregated, but they don't supply all the information that we are talking about here, such as inclusion within the UGB. Another one of those items that we feel that would increase citizen opportunities would be notification at property sale. This would be general notification as to where buyers can receive information about the land use planning program and where to find that information that affects the buyer's property. Another one is individual notification to affected property owners 30 days prior to annexation hearing or action. We're talking about all annexation types and methodologies here. Current statute don't require individual notice for every type of annexation that we go through. Individual notification to affected property owners adjacent to a right-of-way being annexed. Again, there's no current requirement for that. A requirement for at least 2 public hearings as practicable per city for all annexation actions, with the exception of ORS 222-125 annexations, which are generally a single property owner petition to a city for annexation. Again, cities have hearings in different ways. So this could be 1 planning commission hearing and 1 council hearing, 2 city council hearings, a hearings officer hearing, and a planning commission hearing based on the existing procedures of the city. Another item the committee identified for citizen involvement opportunities would be to encourage citizen involvement efforts at the early phases of either development, a particular development application, or overall planning strategies. We recognize that citizens get involved oftentimes too late in these processes to effectively have their concerns considered. Encouragement of community publications, such as newsletters, to provide information about community planning strategies. And very important here, the need for a new additional funding source for sustainable citizen involvement efforts that are supported by policies intended to engage the citizens as early as possible in community planning strategies. we believe that one of the most effective tools to relieve this intense, sometimes political dynamics that occur in communities contemplating annexations is by encouraging upfront citizen involvement. And there are currently less than adequate funding sources available to local governments to provide increased citizen involvement opportunities. From the get-go, I understood that citizen involvement was very important. I have deepened considerably my understanding about how important and the timing involved in that it is to this issue in communities across the state. In terms of economic vitality, the committee did want to bring forward to you the need to stimulate local economies and economic growth through means such as the promotion of business ownership, workforce development, and adequate supply of land zone for industrial land. Most communities, citizens in the state, would support that kind of economic stimulus and growth opportunities. The effects of Measure 5 and 50 on annexations, and we won't go into detail about this, but there are some very direct effects that occurred, including incentives for service provision by districts, the tax rate cap, and lower property values brought onto the tax rolls at annexation. The committee felt that public and private members of the community ought to pay for the benefits that they receive. It's a very broad statement and probably needs some details filled in. But the essence of that is that residential property owners and businesses located within the community should all share in paying for the full cadre of benefits they receive, not just water and wastewater, but telecommunications infrastructure, police, fire, community livability issues that relate to our communities as a whole. In terms of efficiencies, I'm sure the community has looked forward to this piece of the report. There are four bullets here that I hope that you'll take into due consideration. There needs to be a streamlined process for health hazard annexations. The current methodology in statute hasn't been utilized because it is so complex, hasn't been utilized in over 20 years, and currently it's a process that's administered by the Department of Human Services. We looked at combining the double majority and triple majority consent annexations into a single method, likely a modified double majority method, to provide some of the simplification in annexation procedures that we talked about earlier. And the committee, after a lot of discussion, came up with this piece in terms of cherry stems and island annexations, that cities should avoid the use of annexing right-of-ways, cherry stems, solely for purposes of creating an island area. However, it is recognized that cherry stem annexations are sometimes necessary to provide city services to property within the UGB that is not contiguous to city limits. In addition to the already suggested individual property owner notifications that we already mentioned, we do also recommend that any property owners that would be islanded by an annexation would also be individually notified before they are islanded by another annexation, so they could understand where they are in terms of zoning and the full picture of what that community looks like. And we also ask the question, should there be statutory guidance or criteria for counties considering incorporations? Counties are concerned that there is not clear and objective criteria in statute and have brought forward that issue to your committee because incorporation petitions and the required fiscal impact statement analysis or fiscal impact analysis are very expensive both for citizens, as we've seen in Bull Mountain, and governments, as we've seen in Washington County, to review without the benefit of further clear criteria in statute. We're getting close to the end here, so please indulge me. urban service agreements and annexation plan agreements. We suggest that a comprehensive review is recommended for that portion of statute ORS 195, that process, which is the urban service agreement process, annexation plan process, and the annexation methodology that's described there. There is great benefit to that 195 process, and that is the only annexation methodology that requires a full-blown annexation plan and deals with the provision of services within that area to be annexed. However, it's very unlikely, given the passage last session of House Bill 2484 that will eventually change the voting requirement, that communities will want to utilize this process because it is much more expensive, time-consuming process than other choices they can make in terms of annexation methodologies. So we think there's good merit to that 195 process, and that we should the committee should continue to review that and look at perhaps either making some changes to the 195 statutes or looking at a new urban service provider type of annexation plan process. In terms of sustainability, we could really tag this portion as funding needs, but there is absolutely a new need for a new source of funding for long-range planning efforts. There simply is not enough money in local government coffers to do the long-range planning that is currently needed in our communities, especially in communities that are receiving lots of growth very quickly or urbanizing very quickly. And there are needed new sources of funding for the provision of services and infrastructure. In addition to transportation improvements and new replacement systems for water wastewater systems, those cities and communities that are urbanizing quickly have extensive needs for new urbanization, new infrastructure, to accommodate that planned development. Current resource levels, including federal resources, state, local, and private, are mostly inadequate to provide the needs of that new infrastructure systems, including schools, roads, sewers, and those newly developing areas. In terms of the last couple of issues, we put them in the other category. The need for additional education regarding zoning and land use requirements by real estate professionals at the time of licensing. There currently is minimal land use training and education required, and we believe that sector is very important to having a good understanding and knowledge base about the land use requirements and how our systems work. And the last bullet is that a city may not use its contracted authority to withhold the issuance of building permits as condition or requirement of annexation unless the city also provides essential services. This is an issue that we found came up directly for one of our cities that was City of Tigard, and we believe the issue has been resolved temporarily, but that still may have merit for review for your committee for the future. So with that, I'd just like a couple minutes to make a couple of more comments. I did let committee members know and some of the interested citizens that were reviewing and that were present at the committee meetings that if they had comments about the report, that I would be willing to enter them into the record today. And I do have a couple. I did get an email this morning from Jerry Ritter from OCVA, and he did let me know that he has read the report, and he felt that it was very thorough and well-documented and had some very positive things to say about the report and the process. He did have a couple of comments that he wanted to make, essentially about the ORS 195 process and the importance of that, and recognizing from his perspective the importance of the double majority vote, the dual majority vote change that occurred last session in House Bill 2484. He also says he appreciated the time and effort that the group put into its task, And he's hopeful he doesn't have to spend all of his vacation days and floating time coming to Salem in 2007 like he did in 2005. He feels that the underlying root cause of most annexation battles is the cost to the targeted, to those targeted, that cannot be justified by adding benefits, by the added benefits. He believes this is especially true, as the report duly notes, in already urbanized portions of UGBs. He thinks that's something worth continuing to address. I did receive also an email from Julia Brim Edwards, representing Nike, and she had a couple of comments with the report. On page 3, there is a sentence, a generalized sentence that does mention Nike, and feels that it's important to note that Senate Bill 887 forgive me for a moment here, did receive an annexation exemption, but that the bill prohibited annexation without the company's consent. And that consent portion of the bill was extremely important to Nike. And it was not included in the brief explanation of page 3. However, a full copy of the bill is available to you in the appendices of the report. Additionally, she had some concerns that the work group members that were identified as having business representation were not present through the process. And we did, as a work group, discuss there were a few members that of the work group that were appointed that were not present. And the work group decided to insert the statement in the report that they believed that those viewpoints were expressed by other work group members that were present in the process. So that was a directive from the work group that you see in the report. In terms of additional concerns she's outlined in the email, annexation motivations, she is providing the committee today with some relevant documents about that issue. And in the table that you'll see on page 19, 20, 21, these general arguments that are for and against annexation, there was the feeling that the other side of the argument did not appear to be fully represented, that there was a bias towards business and towards government, excuse me, not for business, and a bias for annexation. And I just like to submit to the committee that these were not just arguments that are relevant to Oregon, that are relevant to states across the nation that represent general feelings, both pro and con, about the annexation question. And lastly, on page 33, this is an important item. Under the section of annexation agreements, there's a very small category about exemptions from annexation. And I put this in trying to recognize that there was some legislative action taken last session, and we've seen in prior sessions that have granted exemptions from annexations granted by the legislature. And we had many, and not just local government members of the committee, express their viewpoint that those decisions should be local decisions and should be made in a comprehensive manner, consistent with comprehensive plans, not necessarily as a result of political pressure or legislative action. And Ms. Brim Edwards felt that that statement did not also recognize business concerns, that those policy issues at the state level needed to maintain fairness and balance in annexation laws, and recognize duly that capital investment and economic development in Oregon can be negatively impacted by local political decision-making. So I wanted to get that into the record for you as well. Lastly, the committee work group, and this is lastly, their intention with your approval is to have this document move forward into the hands of the Big Look committee members for their digestion as they move forward in their process over the course of the next year and a half in identifying issues and working with those issues related to urbanization.
You're done.
Bravo.
I am done.
Bravo. Very, very nice job. Committee, any questions? I'm going to ask for questions, Linda, for you that specifically apply to the report before we get into some of the other comments about the report. So, committee members, any questions of Ms. Ludwig? Representative Escobar.
As we know, annexation process is varied in every municipality. There are no two that are, they're similar, but they're not alike. When we start adding time frames, which you were talking about, time frames on people to notify property owners, and et cetera, I want us to be very conscious and conscientious of this because, example, in Southern Oregon, we have one municipality that takes 2 months to annex a piece of property. On the other hand, we have a municipality that takes up to a year. It's because of the layers of time frames that local people have set as well as state statute. So I want us to be very conscious of that because we could bog down a system without knowing it more so than it's bogged down today. I think the municipality that does it in 12 months should go talk to the municipality that does it in 2 months and figure out what they're doing wrong. And I took that information back to the city of Medford because the city of Medford was the 12-month. And talked to a planner, asked him, why are you doing this step and why are you doing that step? And he couldn't answer. And his answer was, we've always done it that way. So if we had not discussed that, and he did cut the annexation process in half just by eliminating useless steps. I think that we need to be very conscious of this because we could, again, get back into this. Instead of 6 months, we could be back to a 9-month frame or an 8-month frame. So, and annexation is, I guess, Ben just goes out and annexes everything. Is that correct in their urban growth boundary? At one whack?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, Ben did use, the city of Ben, the ORS 195 process and did indeed annex their entire UGB. That process, with the service agreements being signed off, a large annexation plan on how they were, the city was going to provide services, that type of process that was initiated in 1993 by the legislature was actually, we found out, intended to annex large regions or entire urban growth boundaries to facilitate the provision of services equitably in an entire region. So, yes, they did use that process.
That's a yes. Whereas in Medford, we do annexation by application. We don't annex anyone unless they apply and ask to be part of the city itself. So it's very, very different and very, very time-consuming sometimes, but very, very short track and on a fast track in other municipalities. So I want to caution us of being very too burdensome with time frames.
Any other comments? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I guess thank you all for the report. I was anticipating it because I know it's an extremely complex topic, and yet as I was reading it during your presentation, not to minimize your presentation, I was able to get through it fairly quickly. I think it's probably one of the clearest reports I've found with respect to a very, very complex subject that I've read in really a long, long time, so I appreciate all the work that's been done on it. I have some questions, though, regarding the cherry stem types of annexations, and the report goes so far to say that the city should avoid using that process solely for the purposes of creating an island area. I guess I'm right in saying that you are not bringing a recommendation. You are not bringing a recommendation to the committee that the city should not have that authority under those conditions. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that is correct. The work group could not go as far as developing consensus in saying that cherry stem annexations should not exist. However, they did recognize that when they were utilized solely for the purposes of creating an island area, that was inappropriate.
Okay. If I just may follow up on that. You also mentioned in your report, and I think rightfully so, that one of the deficiencies in this cherry stem type of annexation is that there's no standards to go by. And the standard you kind of evolve from case law and custom and practice.
Right.
I think that gives so much discretion to the annexing authority that it is almost a slam dunk to believe that this type of annexation will get through very, very easily. Did the committee think of any way to create a bill or a legislative concept that might retain the authority for this type of annexation, but have certain standards that the authority could relate to before approving such annexations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I would suggest that you take a peek at page 28 in the table under efficiencies. The work group did talk about several different ways to actually stem the use of cherry stems, or reduce the use of stem, or completely preempt the use of cherry stems. And midway down that report, one of the items to do that was capping. You'll see a bullet that says cap the allowed length of stem for cherry stem annexations. Work group did talk about that. There wasn't consensus that that was the appropriate way to go about dealing with cherry stems. Another item that came forward with regard to that was to change the definition of island annexations so that encircling territory to create an island by annexation of roads or right-of-ways is no longer allowed. And then lastly, a way of dealing with that, and again, these three ways did not receive consensus by the differing groups represented on the work group, was to change island annexations to only allow a certain percentage of the total perimeter of the road or right-of-way, which would also essentially reduce the length of the cherry stem, or probably essentially the practice of creating an island by annexation of road or right-of-way. So those are ways and issues that the committee did bring forward to discuss about that. Again, there was not consensus about those items, but there was discussion. Also, you might find of interest, as I know that you are very interested in the subject as I am and enjoy the complexities, there is...
He's an attorney.
Yes. Duly noted, Mr. Chair. Duly noted.
I don't know any other behaviors.
There is a table before the appendices in the last part of the report, annexation methodologies used by other states. There's examples of eight other states and how they deal with or don't deal with islands and cherry stems that you might find interesting. Again, I'd like to mention that no other state in the nation, when you look at different annexation methodologies that they utilize, no other state also has the requirement that for the extensive planning process to adopt a UGB with a 20-year supply of land. That same urbanization requirement doesn't exist the same as it is in Oregon and other states. And you need to be cognizant of that when you look at annexation methodologies that are used in other states. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Patrick, we would like to make sure that copies of this report go to the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate. I noticed Lane Cheddarly was here a moment ago, but he's not here. But Lane Cheddarly should have a copy. League of Oregon Cities. Hopefully, Linda, you still have a job when you're done with it. Association of Oregon Counties. And we shall certainly comply to your request that a copy be sent to each member of the Big Look Committee for their further reference.
Thank you.
I'd like to commend you for a job well done in a very short period of time on a very complex issue. Your report is outstanding, and we appreciate your hard work and the committee's hard work. And with that, we discharge you from any further obligation to this committee, which is the best news you've had all day. Now we'll go to any other members of the committee. If you keep your comments fairly brief. Lane, while you were out, I made sure that you got a copy of this report.
I got it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Oh, all right. Then take Lane's name off the list. It'll
just
save
scratch
us, it. It'll save us 37 cents or thereabouts. So. Members of the committee who wish to speak.
Good morning, Chairman Garrard and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Hamilton Trike. I'm a resident of unincorporated Washington County and also represent Friends of Bull Mountain. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to serve as an SB 887 work group committee member. Along with the OCVA, we were the voice of the end users. I can honestly say that through this process, it's really broadened my understanding of annexation issues throughout the state. Before I became involved in this, I had more of a local understanding, and I now have a much greater appreciation for the complexity as you deal with local governments and different counties and regions and what have you. So. It's been a good experience, and I'm very grateful to have had this opportunity. Through robust discussion at the four meetings, many concerns were expressed and many ideas were shared. Ms. Ludwig has done a tremendous amount of work in this, demonstrated by this 117-page document. And I can't say to what degree the document reflects the thoughts and concerns expressed in the work group. I just received it late yesterday afternoon. And so I guess I don't read as quickly as Jerry Ritter and Representative Ackerman. But my point is that I hope that this document could remain a little bit fluid for another week or so that the other members of the work group will have an opportunity to thoroughly review it and maybe make some comments. I don't know if there's an opportunity for that to happen, but I would just like to make that request, if there is, to insert, you know, some additional feedback that may come from folks who just had a look at this, you know, late yesterday. I can't help but notice that somehow, naturally, the two folks who are kind of speaking for the voice of the public ended up on one side, and the municipal folks ended up on the other side. And I felt very accepted in the group. I didn't feel like there was a division at all. But it just struck me as being rather ironic. And I hope as, you know, time progresses and the next session kicks in, that we'll all be blended different places at different tables. And I think that is probably the most important thing that I learned throughout this process, is that when we have folks hunkered into different camps without understanding of one another's perspective, we end up with the contentious battles that I don't think any of us enjoyed and want to see repeated. So, again, I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be just a voice of some folks in the public, and I really respect the work of the OCVA with their broader perspective throughout the state. And I just hope that this sets a precedence in the future and that we can keep the public actively involved in these decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Trick? I also wanted to mention, because Liz Franken is sitting back there, that the chair received probably the nicest letter I've had in my 6 years as a state representative from the League of Women Voters on the ballots that was presented by this committee and by the work group. So, Liz, I thank you for that comment, and I share that with this committee and the work group. So, Steve Bryant?
Chair Garrard and members of the committee, I really didn't plan on saying anything, but just let me respond to Lisa's comment. I too, enjoyed this process. I think many of us came into the process thinking, we'd be lucky to identify four or five items of consensus. And I think the committee worked very hard with some give and take to arrive at the 27 items that you see here. The process worked well. I think it's a great report. This will be tremendously useful to cities around the state, as it will be, I hope, to members of this body. And I hope that it does provide some guidance for some legislative corrections that we can continue to work with you on as we move forward. I also think it's important to give the Big Look Committee an opportunity to digest this as well, and that perhaps rather than act hastily this session with any significant changes, we need to see how that process evolves and consider this as part of the Big Look in terms of how we approach land use planning and urbanization issues in our future.
Any questions of Mr. Bryant? Seeing none, Kelly Ross.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kelly Ross representing the Special Districts Association. I first want to echo the compliments that have been paid to Ms. Ludwig and Mr. Brennan on the management of this committee and the fine work they've done on presenting and digesting the information that we dealt with there. I think, as you'll note by the large number of consensus items that deal with notice to the public and getting better information out to folks, the bottom line on this issue is taking as much effort as possible to build trust among the people, the families, the businesses that are going to be affected by the decisions about where they get their services and who is governing the public agencies that deal with them. And that's the cornerstone of what will make these efforts work in the future, is that allowing people to have transparency in the decisions that are made and building trust of the agencies that deliver services to them. Thank you very much for the opportunity to serve on the committee.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Ross? Seeing none, Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Chair Girard. Richard Reed, I'm the chair of Oregon Communities for Voice and Annexations, and I certainly want to echo the opportunity, I appreciate the opportunity that we had, the Oregon Communities for Voice and Annexations, to be on this work group to begin with. And it occurred to me as we were going through this process that a lot of what I heard anyway in this group, many of you might have heard also as you went around your own communities talking to concerned and being with concerned citizens about growth and its impacts. You do have a tremendous working tool here in this document now that not only shows you a great degree of consensus among what you might have considered to be diverse stakeholders, but also there's opportunities for indications for improvement in our annexation process, which is something I know that you were looking for. Just briefly, it did occur to me that in our general discussions about growth, what we were generally defining growth to be was just simply population increase. And I would urge that as we move forward that we consider that growth needs to be more involved with progress, that when we come up with our policy directives, we take a look at what the polls and surveys continue to tell us people want in their communities. For example, we're looking at people want safe streets, they want schools, abundant water, they want safe places for kids to play and youth to congregate, walkable neighborhoods, community development with less subsidy and debt. All of these things that come up again in the polls and surveys and again in the voting we see could help us define our policy directives. And I'm just going to urge that we focus more on the end, which I think we would agree would be progress in our communities, before we simply put growth, as a priority. The League of Oregon Cities study, Diminishing Returns, gives us a great deal of insight about what's happening that unfortunately is wrong about growth and how we fund it. And I think we can look at the Oregon Progress Board, the Governor's Six Principles, the Citizens for Livable Futures Equity Atlas, and other resources in the state to give us an idea of where we could go with progress. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to serve. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Reed?
Last but not least, Mr. Schleck. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties, and let me just add my voice of thanks to Linda for chairing this group in a very even-handed manner and allowing us all to express our views from a variety of places, and not always the cities and counties come from the same place. And also my thanks to the members of the committee at this point for the work and that they have done. I think as you've heard, everybody learned a lot. This report, I think, is a beginning. It does show that there are some areas of consensus, but those areas of consensus, it's for you to take a look at those and make a determination if you want to go the next step, and whether you want to have a work group or whether you want, how you want to take the next step, I guess, is something that you'll consider and let us know, or decide how you want to go forward if you want to entertain legislation to deal with some of these. From the county perspective, we were very much interested in this issue from a couple different ways, and I just want to mention those to you. Annexation is not always just the cities. And so we were very concerned that how we might deal with annexation or the annexation laws, it affects the municipalities, but it also affects all the special districts. And there is a myriad of special districts around the state providing services to both urban and rural areas of the state. And there are lands that need to be annexed, included to provide, in terms of water districts, fire districts, around the state, a myriad of districts at this point. So the body of law relates to both. This report, in a way, probably emphasizes the municipal annexation more than it does the special district annexation at this point. That's just an observation, but it's something that one needs to be aware of when you look at changes to annexation, how it affects both areas. The other area that we were most interested in was providing urban services inside urban growth boundaries. And that's, I think, is the issue. We have done a good job establishing urban growth boundaries as a whole, trying to manage lands within that, but we've not done a good job of providing the infrastructure to support those. And whether those areas continue to be developed with the fact that those lands are added to municipalities, or whether there's some kind of service districts or something that are created to provide those services, that's extremely important. So there is going to be probably some kind of combination. They both need to work very effectively and be harmonious. I would just close by saying I think it places an additional emphasis on a tool that we created a few years ago called Senate Bill 122 agreements, where the municipalities and the service districts would enter into an agreement by which they would identify the areas that they were going to serve and how they were going to do that and an accommodation. And I think of all the things that our conversations that we had, it emphasized that we should take another look at those 122 agreements and to see how we might do a better job at getting those all implemented, because we spent time, we've put a lot of money into that, the state has. We do not still have those agreements, and I think that would really help the question of annexation to a large extent inside urban growth boundaries. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to serve, and we're here to go to war with you anytime.
Thank you, Art. Appreciate that. There's plenty of wars going on, I guess, right now. That you any questions of Mr. Schlack? Okay, seeing none again. Patrick, would you see that a letter thanking all of the members of the work group, that a letter from this committee goes out to each member, thanking them for their participation and hard work under what were not great opportunities from the standpoint of such a limited time period to come back to us. It is obvious to the chair that our work on annexations has just begun. There is much to do, whether it be streamlining processes, eliminating. I always remember, Linda, you telling me that there were cities had 34 ways of annexing. Maybe it's time to take a look and reduce those 13 at the same time, getting more public notification involved in the process and requiring all the municipalities and entities to be more public in their plans and explaining the positives and the negatives. There's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding in regards to annexation, and we're going to see part of that, I guess, with the Kelo ballot measure coming up this fall. Anyway, again, we thank you all, and committee, any discussion as to what you would like to do at this point with this report, Representative Ackerman?
Mr. Chairman, to further my discussion on the Cherry Stem annexation, I would just like to inform the committee it's my intent to forward a legislative concept which would increase the notification requirements on the annexation, island annexation, and to provide some objective standards on the Cherry Stem type of annexation. And unless there's strong disagreement on the committee, that would be my idea to bring that back at our next meeting. I think it's a process of implementing some of the recommendations in this report.
Any other comments from committee members? Representative Ackerman's volunteering again. He's just really good at that. By the way, we also want to make note at a committee that we have accepted the letter and report from Julia Edwards representing Nike, which we appreciate also, which is such another part of the same discussions. Bob, would you take it upon yourself then to look at this and perhaps draw some concepts up for our next meeting to look at possible legislation and getting this discussion out, because it's obvious things need to be done. So
I'll do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. We will then close the work session on Senate Bill 887 and open a work session informational meeting on the regionalization of LCDC. And Tim, who is the legal arm of the Oregon Farm Bureau, who was one of the original sponsors. Committee, if you look at the bill that Pat included in your packet, it's House Bill 3483. This is the bill that came forth out of the House Land Use Committee, but never, Pat, as I recall, maybe you have a better history, but I don't know whether the Senate ever even took a look at it.
Mr. Chair, you'll note in your packets beneath the bill, I included the staff measure summary and also answer history for that.
And would you tell us what that is?
If you'd hand me that, I'd be glad.
Oh, very good.
Mine is buried at the bottom of my stack, Mr. Chair. Thanks. This bill was, in fact, dealt with by the Land Use Committee. It was from there referred to the House Budget Committee, and it was at that point in the process where it stopped moving through the process. So it did not make it out of the House. It was in the Budget Committee in the House.
Did it have a financial problem of some kind?
It was determined that it was going to have a fiscal impact. However, no fiscal impact statement was developed because the Budget Committee typically does not prepare a budget statement until or a fiscal impact statement until such time as it's scheduled, and it was never. Okay. It never had a hearing.
Just
in the House.
A way of stopping. Mm-hmm. Tim, good afternoon and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, I should say.
Thank you, Chair Girard, members of the committee. For the record, I am Tim Bernasik, the General Counsel of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We're the largest general agriculture membership organization in the state. We have members in virtually every commodity in every county throughout the state. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to talk about a concept that we at Farm Bureau and a number of you have been working on for several sessions, and that is the regionalization of LCDC. As you know, hardly a legislative session concludes without pitched battles over land use planning, and most recently Ballot Measure 37 and now the Big Look Committee are the venues in which most of the conversations about the policy behind land use has occurred and is occurring. And just as these issues have been controversial throughout the state, they've been very controversial within our organization. We have leaders throughout the state that see land use planning issues very, very differently. We have a fairly complex policy process where these debates occur, and it's been interesting for me in the roughly 10 years I've been associated with the Farm Bureau to watch the themes that come out in some of these policy discussions and then hear them later at the legislative level as well. And last session, we worked with Representative Dallum, you, Mr. Chair, and others on what was first House Bill 3475, and then, as you mentioned, 3483, which would have regionalized the LCDC. It is our hope that in working with all of you, we can build on a lot of what we learned in 2007 and move this in 2005 to move this issue forward in 2007. Before discussing some of the particular provisions, I thought I'd take a step back and talk about why we think this is an important topic now. And it's a refrain you've heard many, many times over and over, and that is, one size simply does not fit all. And what may work in Salem doesn't work in fill in the blank. I certainly hear that in my neighborhood and where I live in Southwest Portland, and then through my travels throughout the state, most recently Representative Garrard down to your area, we hear various variations of that theme over and over again. And whether justified or not, I think we can all agree that the public has clamored for change, and through Ballot Measure 37, we have certain change occurring. And I guess I would pose before you that there may be future changes going to occur if we don't wrestle with these issues. And certainly I think that's one of the reasons that the Big Look Committee has been put together, and why I think issues like regionalization and other sort of bigger picture looks at how we do land use planning in the state is important. That being said, we at Farm Bureau believe it would be a mistake to interpret the criticism of land use planning as one size does not fit all to mean that the public does not like planning and that we at Farm Bureau don't like planning. I have to pause here and thank Lynn Lundquist and the Oregon Business Association for allowing me to take a real hard look at their land use study that was done now a little over a year ago, but it was right in the wake of Measure 37 passing. I think it was in March or April after Measure 37 passed. And one of the things that came out is that 67% of the public believes that protecting private property rights is fundamentally important, and but at the same time, support for land use planning is also very strong, and most importantly, does at Farm Bureau, 64% of the public wants to protect farmland for farming. So I think that what's being asked for by the public, if we really get down and look at it, is that land use planning be done, but it be done more effectively. And we believe that by regionalizing LCDC, it would go a long way towards realizing that goal of making our land use planning system more effective. And the reason it would do that is regionalization would allow for more local decisions, at least as we envision regionalization, would allow for more local decision making, but still maintain what we think is very important, a statewide uniformity of goals in the planning process. So what have we been doing since last session? I guess I should say that this is our view of this is very much a work in process. We've been talking to groups and massaging the details. But the overall concept, again, is to take that rulemaking authority and compliance process from Salem and statewide LCDC and break that down into the several regions. The way we looked at it last session was to use the existing regions of LCDC and use those, but I think we're very open to maybe there are some better regions that may make better sense, either for agriculture. I know, for example, in discussions with Director Shetterly that, transportation is broken down into various regions. So I think it's one thing that we would probably need to look at is how those regions would be made up. But the idea would be they would develop their own rules for their region, would deal with county comprehensive plan review and those kinds of issues under the umbrella of statewide, general statewide goals. So we'd have a uniform, and they would also develop uniform procedural rules so that one of the things in talking to John Chandler and some of the home builders is they're kind of, geez, you know, you regionalize LCDC, then we've got, you know, all these various processes throughout the state that we need to deal with, and I think that's a fair criticism. I think one of the ways we deal with that is to have a uniform process for how rules are adopted, timelines, notice procedures, so that as you travel throughout the various regions, the process is the same, but the substantive rules may be very, very different. Again, we hope to continue to talk to other groups about this. We realize that this is a very, very big step. We also believe it's an important step in making sure that Oregon maintains a strong land use planning system and one that does what I believe, and I wrote an article in a law review journal, that I think that land use planning done properly can maximize private property rights, and that is the best way that to do that. And I think that the concern that the public has had is that they're not necessarily seeing that with our current system. So I guess the sense of urgency that Farm Bureau brings to this is that in order to maintain the system that we have, we need to improve it, and we think that regionalization is one of the best ways to make that happen. So I again very much appreciate the opportunity to be here to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, thank you for allowing me to come, Chair Girard.
Thank you, Tim. Committee, there is a giant wall forming by the presence of the Big Look Committee that any kind of substantive legislation produced from the House or the Senate, this happens to be the only interim land use committee that's working during the interim from the legislature. So we felt it our obligation. My only criticism of the Big Look Committee is that the Big Look's going to take too long, and that the people of Oregon need, especially in this area of one size does not fit all, needs the legislature to stand up and do something that's positive and that will help land use in Oregon and help simplify it. So, of course, we have the question of who will be in the governor's chair when the next legislative session takes place. So we're just going forward with this because, A, we believe it was a good bill in the last session. No one can explain to me what happened to the bill and why it never got out of budget, but it didn't, because this bill had no opposition when it moved out of the House committee, to my knowledge. I think Lane was probably fidgeting in the chair at the time that we discussed this, but to my knowledge, when it left our committee in the House, there was no organized opposition to it. So that's why we grabbed it and thought this is a good area to move forward on, and I still believe that, and Tim, I'm glad to see that you do too, along with the Farm Bureau. So kind of with that preface, we certainly intend to send a copy. We're not going to make this a committee bill today, but it will be on our agenda in October as a committee bill to pre-file. But it's long, and I wanted the committee to have enough time to fully study and take a look at what this bill does. And so it will be on the agenda in October for us to take a vote on to see whether we want to send it forward for pre-filing. And that was the preface for today's putting it on the agenda, was to familiarize the committee with it and give the committee an opportunity to review it in its entirety. So any questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I concur with your remarks on bringing the bill back for another small look, I guess, rather than a big look.
A little look.
I do have a concern, and I'm going to state it for the record now. I hope that perhaps Lane Shetterly and others can relate to it at our next meeting. That is on page 2 of the bill in its subsection, section 2, sub 7, I believe. The Regional Commission shall adopt, amend, and revise rules necessary for the implementation of statewide land use planning goals in the region. I guess my question is that take some authority away from LCDC in the formulation and implementation of the statewide planning goals? Are we giving the regional councils the authority to amend statewide goals? I would like that question addressed in the next hearing, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Thank you.
Tim, would you care to respond to the question? And we'll get Lane up here in a moment if he cares to make a comment on it.
Yeah, Chair Girard and Representative Ackerman, we'll look at the specific language, but the intent of the bill certainly was to leave the goal-making process up with the statewide at the statewide level. And some of the concerns that folks have mentioned is actually, well, how do you, you know, right now the goals are written, a lot of them, in a fair amount of detail, and so I think we'd have to look at that. I think the idea is that the goals would be much more general in nature, and then specific rules would be developed at the regional level. And a concern about, well, how do you provide some accountability, though, or some connectedness between the statewide LCDC and those regions? And one of the concepts that we've talked about in the interim is that, well, maybe the best way to do that is to make sure that those that the chairs of the regional LCDC are elected by the local local commission, and then the chairs then are the representatives at statewide LCDC. So there's a connection there. But again, to your specific question about whether the goals themselves are written at the regional level, the intent is no. That still there needs to be a statewide look at how our goals read, but also I guess the intent would be that the goals would be much more general and allow for some of the specific rules to be developed at the local level. If you'd allow me one more kind of iteration on detail, because the next question is, well, what happens then if there's an issue where certain regional rules may not meet or the statewide LCDC doesn't think that they're in accord with the statewide goal? And what we've envisioned, and I think it's encompassed in the bill, is that the process would be then the state LCDC could appeal or challenge those rules to LUBA. So there'd be more authority given to LUBA. So there'd be an outside quasi-judicial body that would look at that. So there wouldn't be necessarily a veto at the statewide level, but you'd have someone looking over that could make that case to LUBA. Likewise, if a county felt that the region's review of its comprehensive plan was an error, that too would be something that we could kick over to LUBA and allow an independent look. So you have these various levels that have very important responsibilities, but there isn't the current, veto approach of the statewide commission envisioned in the bill that we drafted.
I'm just suggesting, I agree with the intent. As I read the bill very, very quickly again for the first time in many months, I'm just suggesting there's a conflict and we should hear it out next time. Thank you.
And I'm assuming, Tim, that would be preferable to having each decision go back to a local circuit court.
Chair Gar, that's correct. And the idea was to give, you know, LUBA has some expertise in land use planning, and the thought was that would be a better venue and allow for more uniformity, perhaps, than having the several circuit courts wrestling with that.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to have you here. I didn't have the benefit of looking at this and listening to the discussion the last session. I have one comment and a question. And is this the bill we're going to reintroduce? I mean, if I read through this, are you planning on changing this bill in any way before we do that?
Chair Gard, Representative Byer, I guess it's obviously ultimately up to the what Chair Gard would like to do with it. My hope would be that there are a lot of constituent groups, for example, Oregonians in Action, Thousand Friends, others that we've been talking to that have had some, I think, very good suggestions and concerns at the detail level that, at least from my perspective, I think it would be nice to have a couple months now to, we've had these discussions, we've met with Director Shetterly, and he again expressed that they, because of the big look, they won't be able to support this concept now, but we've engaged them, we're talking to these various groups, but I think that there may be some tweaks that we'd like to suggest, and if it makes sense in October, that might be a time that we could maybe report back and talk about at least what we're hearing. But I guess my sense is this is such a big issue, and we really do want, at least from my perspective, a lot of voices to come in now so we can craft a good bill. Because as Chair Girard said, there really was, with the exception of concerns that Director Shetterly expressed last session, there was no opposition to this bill. And I think there were a lot of people that at least have come up to us in the interim and said, well, you know, what about doing it this way? And, you know, how are we going to select these regional directors? And if we can, I guess, methodically, to the extent we can work some of these things out in the next couple months, I think it may make for a better process going forward out there. But I guess ultimately that's the decision that you all have to make, whether it's this exact bill or some of the, if you like, some of the ideas that we come up with in our discussions.
Representative, in response to that, yes, it's our intent to take what we have before us today and allow Tim these couple extra months to see what positive changes we could make. I don't think we can alleviate any of Mr. Shetterly's concerns, but we want as good a bill as possible so that in October we could pre-file this, make sure it's going to get on the table for discussion. And Tim, you used the word urgency, and I really believe that. I really believe the people need something positive coming out of the legislature and from all of us involved with land use that makes some substantial changes before the Big Look Committee ever. I mean, that's still 4 or 5 years down the line before we even begin to understand what they're after, so, or what they feel is going to be changed. So it is this bill that we intend to move forward with.
Thank you. And my comment, and I don't want you to take this as opposing the bill or supporting it, because, like I said, I haven't had the benefit of the conversation. But I think it's somewhat ironic that we're sitting here talking about streamlining land use across the, I mean, not annexation across the state, annexation policies, because there's too many, it's too complicated. But yet we're talking about expanding. And you've touched on it a little bit, how you would want it to work, but it seems like these are, you know, similar, but we're going in two different directions on them. So,
Tim? Chair Girard, Representative Beyer, I think that is interesting, and it was sitting back there listening to the comments, it was interesting to note that as well. But I guess the difference I see here is that there still is going to be a statewide LCDC. There still is a process for goals and some uniformity of processes and procedures. But I think what our 30-plus year experiment in statewide land use planning has shown up to date is that there really are, in this complicated process of which, you know, annexation is just a part of all of land use planning, that there are very real differences throughout the state in how people view, you know, farmland protection, urbanization, and all these other issues. And so with some caveats there and some statewide protections, I think that I think there are still going to be pitched battles over land use planning, but I think the importance of regionalization as we envision it is that there's a sense that's missing now that local people have an ability to reach it and touch it and grab a hold of it. Now, whether it's real or not, whether it ends up being that way, Director Shetterly made a comment that, you know, when you have some of these regional processes, sometimes it's more difficult to get to solution, and that very well may play out. But the point is that getting buy-in and getting people to feel better about the process and having a route where their regional differences can be expressed differently, we think at the Farm Bureau it's time to give that a try with those kind of big picture goals still in place to oversee and uniform procedures there. We think that might be an improvement, but it is no doubt a big, big change.
And I think the potential to weave in some of the annexation issues that have been brought before into this concept would be possible. In that we're looking at streamlining, making it simpler, putting the people back in touch, really, with their governments. I think both issues do come forward in that respect, and perhaps is a way that we can move both in that direction, and it's a very good point. Very good point. Do you have any other questions?
No, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Escobar.
I think this is a, I agree with Representative Ackerman, this is a great concept because what you're doing is you're localizing and regionalizing the process where people have to go instead of have to go to Salem, they can go to their specific region. But the broad-based policy of DLCDC in the state should be implemented, but more importantly, we need flexibility under that umbrella and then under that policy in order to function as a local regionalization, regional or a local municipality. What's good for Lakeview is not good for Portland. What's good for Portland is not good for Ontario or Bend. So I think that this will hopefully cut some of that away. A good friend of mine, which was one of the best planners I think that I'd been around, named Jim Eisenhart, he just passed away here recently. He was a planner in Medford for, I don't know, 25, 30 years. And he said when he first started, there was a three-ring binders of land use laws. And he was retiring, and he had a pretty good-sized office, and he said, today, I could fill this office clear to the ceiling and go down the hall with all the AR rulings that have been implemented in the state of Oregon. And he said, I defy you to find one individual in the state of Oregon that understands all those. Pretty interesting insight. Of course, he was retiring. He had nothing to lose. But that got to the complexity of where we're at today. You have people that are making rules, and one size does not fit all. And I think this is a great, great way to get a foothold on getting local input into local issues.
Any other comments from the committee? Tim, thank you very much.
Representative Ackerman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just more worried about us being preempted by the big look people, and I'm wondering if there's some way that maybe the chair can mitigate that by either talking to them or talking to the speaker and getting some clearance. Otherwise, I feel we should go forward. I think that's our responsibility under our authority for this committee. And I'm just kind of wondering, we go through a huge, huge exercise, and you get the message, you get a call from the speaker's office in February saying it's preempted, you know.
The chair will be meeting with the speaker next week, and we will be discussing this very issue. And we will keep the Big Look Committee informed of what we're doing, as we have on all of the issues that came before this committee today, but in that it's the only functioning committee in land use going on during the interim, we feel that responsibility. Whether you want to consider it to be little nudges to the Big Look of some of us on this committee have been involved in land use for over 6 years. So I like to think and give this committee some credit that we have a little validity as to land use laws and what is appropriate, at least to try to move in a direction or not. So, but yes, the Big Look Committee is there, and we certainly want to work with them. But again, my problem with the Big Look is that it's going to be too long before we get a look at the Big Look. So, any other questions? But Representative Ackerman, I will inform the committee after I've met with the speaker in this regard. And Tim, I'll get back to you and let you know too.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session and informational meeting on House Bill 3483, and that will be back, committee, in the first week in October. And Representative Beyer, if you have any kind of feelings toward something that can be added to this bill or something that can be done with the annexations piece, please let the committee know. We'll be happy to work with you. Mr. Shetterly, it's so nice to see you. You're just the topic of discussion every time we turn around. We'll just opened the informational meeting now on ballot measure 37 claims process, and we have Lane Shettley, the director of DLCD. And Lane, I don't know whether you care to comment on our previous discussion or not at this point. I know we've had previous discussions in the committee, and you've made your feelings known in that regard. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Confirm what Tim earlier testified to you, that we have had discussions about this, and Mr. Chair, you and I have had conversations before about Big Look and this bill, and I do know where you're coming from on which process is preferable to you. I did communicate to Tim, of course, that under the bill that was passed and with the task force that was appointed by the Speaker and by the Governor and by the Senate President, they have themselves addressed ways in which the program could better reflect regional differences, not just in terms of political boundaries, but also in terms of population, in terms of topography, just a myriad of ways that the program could better reflect local and regional differences. They've made that a part of the scope of their review of the land use planning program, and so I have explained to Tim that out of loyalty to the bill and to the task force that we are directed to staff, we will follow and support their process, which would take the longer term on that. But again, I've made that clear, and I certainly respect where you're coming from on that. I don't think I'll spend any time, unless you have any other questions, particularly on the specific issues of the bill. I'd be happy to come back at some point when it's either up for consideration or you have something more concrete in front of you and have that conversation.
Certainly in October we'd like
to
have you
back. I'll be glad to be back.
Any committee member have a question on that? Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
$2.4 million from the e-board.
Thank you, sir.
How are you spending it?
Well, that's what we'll tell you. Actually, since a good part of that is litigation expense, and I know that Stephanie Striffler is next on your agenda, Mr. Chair, I would certainly welcome, and it's in your agenda, but if you want to have Stephanie up together, we may be able to. There's a lot of crossover now between claims and claim litigation because it's all part and parcel of the same thing, and I would be happy to have her join me at the table if you want to bring her up now.
The chair has no problem with that. Stephanie, if you'd like to come up. I promised the committee we'd be done by noon, okay. So that is your obligation, Lane.
Oh, not my obligation. It's my pleasure.
Oh, he's so glib.
Mr. Chair, what I have brought you in a roundabout way to address the question, what are we doing? A couple of things. You have a memorandum from me dated August 1 that is a summary of the current claim numbers. I say current as of last Friday. Attached to that is a very cursory outline of litigation cases pending on Measure 37 claims. Stephanie can certainly actually address that much more in much more detail than I. And then also you have a chart that shows it's called the Weekly Claims Processing Report that shows you a week by week volume of claims in. I've also distributed this morning, also have, with reference to the question about emergency board funding, I've given the committee a copy of our letter to the emergency board that went in jointly from the Department of Justice and DLCD and the Department of Administrative Services, making the request for additional funding, and occurred to me this morning I should also bring over to you sort of the rest of the story and what happened, and that is why I've asked committee staff to distribute to you a document entitled Summary of Emergency Board Action, and on page 2 of that, under Natural Resources, that first paragraph summarizes the emergency board action with regard to funding. And it's easy to explain in concept. The funding request was to provide additional staff to deal with the volume of claims in the door, to make sure that we have the capacity to process those claims in a timely manner. That means within 180 days of the day that the claim is received, recognizing that failing to do that exposes the state to liability for damages, attorney fees, and costs. So it's a very important obligation that we have to make sure that all of these claims are done and out the door in a timely manner. And so staffing to enable that given the increased volume of claims over what we had based, over what all of us had based the budget on during the last session. And the other piece of the emergency board funding was for litigation expense. When, and the e-board knows this and LFO knows it, when our budget was crafted during the last legislative session, we knew that there was something out there in terms of prospective litigation and costs that would be associated with that. Nobody knew at that point in time in the session what the extent of that would be. And so it was reserved for the department and for DOJ to come back to the e-board to request funding relative to litigation expenses after we had some experience under our belt and could get a better sense of what that volume and possible cost would be. So that was the other piece of the e-board funding that we received. It was money for litigation expense. And so there's really nothing new in that. It's just a matter of addressing the new volumes of claims coming in to make sure that those are reviewed in a timely manner, and then also to address the cost of litigation that had not been addressed in the budget during the last session. Just a couple of other things, and then I'll stop and either turn it over to Stephanie or answer any questions you may have. On the daily average of claims received, if you look at this, you will notice that last March we begin with a week in which there were 90 claims received. That happens to be the week after which the Supreme Court decision in the McPherson case became effective. If you recall, last October, Measure 37 was suspended. At least our ability to process claims and issue decisions was suspended by the trial court decision in the McPherson case that declared the measure to be unconstitutional. We appealed that to the Supreme Court, and through the good work of the Department of Justice, were successful in that appeal to have the trial court decision reversed and the measure reinstated as being constitutional. That became effective in March, and you see there that high number of claims in those first couple of weeks that really reflect, I think, the pent-up claims that were out there ready to come in while the measure was suspended. Those claims that came in March are right now, we're in what we call the bulge, because those claims have moved forward in the process so that we will be getting those claims out the door here within this next month. We've got a week coming up where we will be getting 90 claims out the door in 1 week. And the week after that, 67 claims out the door with new claims coming in. And so that was part of our timing, too, to get to e-board in time to, we hope, have staffing up to be able to especially deal with this bulge in claims coming through. But even as volumes have come down since that extraordinary volume in late March, we are still receiving claims on a regular basis at substantially higher volume than we were receiving last year during the legislative session. And if I could be so bold as to make a prediction, I think that as we approach the end of the year, I think we're going to see an increase in claims over what even our volumes are today. There is a date in ballot measure 37. It's not a date, but it's effectively a date of December 2 of this year. That I think has people concerned that, as to its effect on the claims process. The measure says that for claims based on regulations enacted before the effective date of the measure, which was December of 2004, property owners have 2 years within which to file a claim, which would be December of this year. Now, the measure goes on to say, or within 2 years after that regulation is first imposed as an approval criteria. I think that's the language. No one's exactly sure what that means or whether that, in fact, extends that 2 years indefinitely. But I think there is at least enough concern based on the seminars and Measure 37 programs and meetings that I'm attending statewide. There is at least enough concern that that December date means something. That we expect that most people are going to be sure to try to get their claims in before that December 2nd deadline. And so I'm predicting that this chart will look something like a broad U by the time we get to the end of the year, with an increase in claims coming up as we approach December. Otherwise, Mr. Chair, we are getting claims out the door. successfully. We are in litigation on several fronts, as Ms. Striffler will tell you. We're just continuing on with the order of business of keeping this thing moving forward. I've reported to you before generally on the claims process. I don't mean to repeat that, but I'll certainly be happy to answer questions if you have any based on what I've given you so far.
Any questions of Director Shadow, Representative Ackerman?
I've forgotten, Lane, whether your department is charging fees to the applicants for the processing of Measure 37.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, no, we're not. There are no fees required by the state.
I know they're not required, but has there been any discussion that fees should be assessed in your discussion with the board or the governor's office?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, fee authority would have to be given through the budgeting process, and that's not part of our budget coming in. We certainly didn't have fee authority in this biennium out of our budget. So I guess it really would be a legislative decision whether or not to authorize the imposition of fees for the processing of Measure 37 claims.
Thank you. I just want to say this is a 100% public subsidy that grants many, many people a tremendous financial windfall. I think it's bad policy not to charge some fees to cover the public costs of processing these claims, but if we need legislative authority to direct the department to do that, then I think that's something that should be considered next session.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, just to clarify, the fee authority would be to DAS and not to our department, since DAS is the receiving agency for all Measure 37 claims.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Lane, it seems like since there was kind of a hold put on with that previous lawsuit, that December 2nd date has to maybe be flexible, but maybe Stephanie's going to speak to that. If not, I hope she will. And perhaps she has a report on the Crook and Jackson County lawsuits. So, Stephanie, why don't you proceed and we'll get all of our answers.
Yeah.
We didn't oh, I'm all ears.
We really didn't need you, Lynn.
That's the usual.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Stephanie Striffler, special counsel to the Attorney General. And I've provided two handouts. One is a list of pending litigation. It's slightly different from the list Lane had, because the list Lane has is pure claims litigation, and there's also litigation, Measure 37 litigation, that comes up in different contexts besides claims directly, direct challenges to claims orders. And then the other document that I've provided is very timely related to your request for information on the Crook County case. At about 4:30 yesterday afternoon, I received a decision from the Crook County Circuit Court, so we've handed that out. Have too much suspense, I guess.
Let's eliminate the shuffling of pages.
Yeah, I can report that the court did find invalid the aspect of Crook County's Measure 37 ordinance that provides that Measure 37 waivers are transferable to subsequent owners purely on recording with the county. So what the Crook County Circuit Court has said is that waivers granted are not automatically transferable to a subsequent owner without further action taken by the owner who obtained the waiver to vest the use. And there's case law standards about what vesting is, and how what you have to do to get there requires a substantial investment, and it's really a case-by-case kind of question as to what that means. So I know there's often many law school type questions about what if I do this, would that vest the use, and I hope I can avoid trying to answer those.
Representative Escobar, I had a question.
Does this include children and grandchildren that the properties pass down generation after generation?
Yes, under Measure 37, there is specific treatment, as you know, for family members.
Correct.
That relates only to who qualifies for compensation. Mm-hmm. The ordinance in Crook County didn't deal with compensation and family members. It just said generally that anyone who obtains a waiver can transfer that waiver to somebody else as long as that waiver has been recorded. And what the decision says is regardless of whether that transfer is to a family member or not, the use has to be vested before that right pursuant to the waiver can be transferred. I hope I didn't make that sound too confusing. But Measure 37 treats waivers and compensation differently in terms of family members.
Proceed.
Just some general comments about Measure 37 litigation. As we told the e-board would happen, we are now working fast and furiously on these cases. We have about 60 cases. We have filed pleadings in almost all of them by this point. We've filed briefs in, I think, about 25 of them. We're trying to move these cases through. And we've gotten to the stage where we're starting to get a number of trial court decisions. We only have one case that's in the appellate system at this point in the Court of Appeals, and that's the case having to do with the requirements of the Gorge Scenic Area Act and how Measure 37 applies there. So that's the only case at this point that's hit the Court of Appeals. That'll be the next wave, though, because we are getting a lot of circuit court decisions. Some of the issues that we're getting decisions on, one of the big issues has to do with the applicability of the Administrative Procedures Act to state decisions under Measure 37, and we have mixed decisions from the circuit courts at this point on that. Clackamas County, Marion County, and Deschutes County have come up with varying answers to that question. So we will get to the appellate courts pretty quickly on that one, I think. Then another issue that we have a recent decision on relates to the matter that Representative Esquivel asked about, and that is the difference between how compensation and waivers are determined if property has been transferred to a family member. And the Marion County Circuit Court ruled that compensation may relate back to an earlier acquisition by a family member, the right to compensation, but that the ability to obtain a waiver in lieu of compensation does not. And that's pretty much what the court said. Measure 37 says that the language clearly says. So that's another one that will no doubt hit the appellate courts, and that issue is in several other cases as well. Another issue that we have recent determination on is in a case filed by Multnomah County, and that has to do with what kind of evidence suffices to determine that there's been a diminution in value caused by a regulation in a Measure 37 claim, and the court did find that the evidence in that case sufficed to support the state's order in terms of whether or not there had been a diminution in value. And then there's a variety of cases that really have to do with whether or not the owner's use has truly been restricted by the regulation that they claim. We have a case, the Wallen case, in which the court has just ruled that actually the owner can do now what they could do when they acquired the property. So they don't have a basis for a Measure 37 claim. The new regulations are not actually more restrictive. And we have another case that involves the question of was the use that the claimant is asking for, was that allowed when they acquired the property? And we have the Robeson case, and the court said, no, the use that this person wants was not permitted at the time that they acquired the property. So they don't have a basis for a Measure 37 claim. Then there's a variety of cases pending having to do with who actually has an interest in the property. You've probably seen some newspaper reports about the question of when a spouse has an interest in the property, a spouse who's not on the deed, or another family member whose name is not on the deed. We've had a decision in Marion County in the Schaefer case on that question, which the court said if the name was not on the deed, that person does not have a qualifying interest under Measure 37, and there's several other cases in different forms where that issue's present. Then we have questions where we don't have rulings yet, but questions about various in ownership interests and whether they qualify under Measure 37. Trust deeds, land sale contracts, transfers to corporations or trusts. And there's quite a variety of those, and we've briefed many of them, and those are getting sorted out also. And another big issue that we have is the question of when someone acquired their property after the statewide land use planning goals were adopted, but before acknowledgement of the local comprehensive plan under state law and precedent, the goals apply directly to that person's use of the property, even if the plan hasn't yet been acknowledged. And there's some folks who are disputing that. We have that issue in several cases. We also had, in one case, the issue raised of whether the state has authority to waive state statutes. And that question has been withdrawn from the case in which it was raised, which was a case in Multnomah County. So we right now do not have that issue currently pending in litigation. We may well see it again, though. And as we've said before, that's a pretty big one. Another big issue that's out there is the question of the need for a state waiver in addition to a local government waiver. And we've got that in some cases. So it's really, as I say, we're at a hot and heavy point right now, getting lots of decisions, and we'll keep briefing those cases, getting decisions, and then next time you hear from us, we'll be talking about what the appellate courts are doing with them. I should mention, too, that the handout that I provided is on DOJ's website, the list of cases, and we are now adding to our website our briefs in those cases. So you can go to our website and look at the name of a case and get copies of our briefs, and it also gives instructions how to go to DLCD's website and see the claims order that the case may involve.
Representative Askew.
Yes, Measure 37, didn't it state that these would be reviewed by local government? Something of that nature?
Mm-hmm. Measure 37 says that local governments can provide procedures for processing Measure 37 claims. That may be what you're thinking of, and that would apply to claims that are made with the local government.
Yeah. Representative Greenwood?
Thank you, sir.
Make it good, because your wife's in the room now.
She's used to me babbling without making any sense. 50 years this month, she's been here.
Well, congratulations.
Great.
50 years of you, Harriet.
you're the
one we're applauding.
Mr. Chair, it's a good thing there's no term limits.
Yeah.
It just shows I have better taste than she has. Wayne, can we just go back? I'm interested in the process that gets from a yes answer, a no answer, and a lawsuit. And if you could sort of talk about those decision points. There are, what, 979 final orders that have been issued. Those are yes and no orders, I assume. Is that right? And then there's the 1038 claims that have been closed.
Yeah.
Is that the no answers?
No, thank you, Representative, or Chair Representative Greenlick. Closed would include claims that may have been withdrawn. All of the decisions, both yes and no, would be reflected in that 979 number.
Okay.
And
how many yes and how many no, roughly? I mean, is it 50-50?
No, I would say, although I want to qualify this, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I would say that probably 90% are yeses in terms of a finding of a valid claim, a finding of a waiver. However, there are a lot of permutations of yes, in the sense that, for instance, back to the family ownership, if a claim is filed by a current property owner whose grandfather acquired the property back in 1930, the current owner's father inherited the property in 1960, and now the current owner has acquired the property, let's say, in 2000. We would look at that and say that's a valid claim because for compensation purposes, you go back to when grandfather acquired the property and you determine the validity of the claim based on regulations that have been enacted since that date for compensation purposes. But this gets back to what Stephanie said then, that for the purpose of a waiver, what Measure 37 says is that a waiver goes back to allow the current owner of the property the right to use the property when they acquired the property, which is different than going back to 1930 as far as waiver uses goes. And so we would say it's a valid claim, waiver granted back to 2000, which doesn't feel like a yes if you're on the receiving end of that. And there also then are the issues of where we grant a waiver or we say that the claim is valid, but subject, someone has come in, let's say, with 100 acres of exclusive farm use land that they want to subdivide into 1-acre parcels, and they acquired the property, let's say, in 1976. There have been regulations that have become effective since 1976 to today. And we would allow that claim back to 1976, but in 1976, there still were regulations in place. Goal 3 was in effect. Chapter 215 had been adopted. And so we would say, yes, you have a valid waiver, but not back to 1-acre subdivision, probably, but to whatever you could have done in 1976 under the applicable standards then of Goal 3 and Chapter 215. So, again, that's a waiver, but it's not a clean waiver in the sense of yes, go do everything that you asked to be able to do. So it gets very complicated in describing waivers and denials. The outright denials based on either no ownership interest or finding that the current regulations don't restrict the property at all relative to what might have been in place when the property is acquired, those are very rare. Again, probably not more than 1 out of 10. More common are those waivers that are waivers but may not be waivers to the full extent of the use for which the claim was filed.
Yeah, I followed just a little bit one time.
Yeah.
And what now?
You rarely ask a question that's uncomplicated, so.
Yeah.
There are
no, that was a great answer.
No.
That's very well. But the next question is, can you speculate, either of you, on what now converts that decision to a court case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think what converts that decision to a court case is the extent to which a claimant is, number one, satisfied or not satisfied with the outcome, number two, the extent to which they agree or disagree with the outcome, and then I would suppose the extent to which they feel like litigating it. I think, I don't know if Stephanie mentioned, we're seeing about a 6% rate of claims resulting in litigation. I don't know what that means, and many of them are cases involving the very same questions, such as marriage or transfers to corporations or other business entities. So it's not as if they're all different. Many of them involve the same question just being applied to multiple claim decisions.
Thank you, sir.
And any other questions?
And that's 6% of the 900.
That's correct.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, as I recall last session, we waited a long time for the Senate to bring us a work product. And I think the flaw in that was that there were massive substantive changes which we just couldn't all get around to vote on successfully. We had some attempt in the House to adopt that also, and it also was failed. We just didn't have enough time. I guess my question is, through this body of case law that is being developed now, do you feel it's the role of your department to let us know how we could pass discrete statutes, either procedurally or substantively, which would make the litigation process more streamlined? Like this evidence issue, what quantum of evidence is necessary to establish damage or ownership or stuff like that, that would just cut down maybe on the litigation, because as we know, the bill didn't provide any substantive guidelines for the adjudication of these claims. Is that your role, or is that something we should look at, or do we wait for the usual suspects to come forth in the next session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, it's a good question. I think our role is to keep you informed as to the issues that are evolving, and as we have done today and will do on every invitation, and sometimes even when not invited, advise you of developments in the measure. Having been personally involved in those discussions for 6 months last session, you used one phrase that I think is probably raises the is most problematic in the discussions about Measure 37. You asked if there was one or a few discrete issues. My experience is that there are no discrete issues in ballot Measure 37. That once you begin in the political process, once you begin to touch one, there are tendrils and tendons and hydraulics that bring into play a host of other issues as other members then are asked to weigh in on that one. We tried, as you may recall, and experience is the teacher here, I think we began, as I recall, with a fairly narrow bill concept last session that as we went through the several months of discussions, Mr. Chair, I think we at one point delivered to you a bill that was probably 50 or 60 pages that then died of its own weight, and which brought us back at the end of the session to a narrower, again, more discreet effort. And I think that was the bill ultimately that the House passed, Senate Bill 1037, in its amended form. But even at that discrete level, with only the smaller number of issues, we weren't successful in getting that out through the process. And that, to me, my experience has told me is really the nub of legislative enactment in Measure 37, that it is very hard to be discreet.
Thank you.
A couple of quick questions. Blaine, how many additional staff have you hired? Is that on what basis do you hire someone? Just are they temporary or full time or?
Mr. Chair, all of the positions funded for ballot Measure 37 are limited duration.
Okay.
So we will come back in next session to justify whatever the number of positions we need based on what we project the volume of claims to be through the next biennium. On that, if I'm right, and I may be wrong, and we'll be back talking about this next session, if I'm right and we have the bulk of our claims in the door sometime in December, there will be a heavy workload through June, because that's our 180 days to get those out. And we may be able to see by March or April or May next year if there is indeed a fall off in the number of claims coming in, which would indicate then that we will need fewer people in the next biennium to manage these Measure 37 claims. At this point, I can count bodies. I don't have off the top of my head FTE. We have about six people exclusively devoted to ballot Measure 37. We are in the process of recruiting for the positions that were authorized just in June. Those are out. But I can tell you that, especially given the number of claims that are currently in the pipeline and on the desk to be moved out, we are still in an all-hands-on-deck situation in the department, where I believe I can faithfully say that every position that is not limited by funding, that is federal funds, for instance, that would not permit this, everybody in the department that is not limited by funding is engaged in claims review at this time.
Boy, I could see how much fun it would be writing an ad for the vacant jobs, you know.
You know.
Who the heck would ever apply?
You know, Mr. Chair, it is a good question. I tell you, though, continually am surprised by the quality of people who are able to get. Sometimes the recruitments take a little extra time, and the fact that we've done now is just go with an open recruitment so that we don't keep going out for 3 weeks and then finding we got, you know, one person or nobody, and then have to reopen again. So we've learned our lesson there and have an open recruitment. But there are people out there, and highly qualified people, for whom either just on the basis of where they are in changing careers or in their lives or family situations, move to Oregon, want to get their foot in the door and figure out what's going on here. There are people who are applying for these positions.
So you have some former cooks and waitresses?
Mr. Chair, we have highly qualified and skilled individuals working in these positions, I'm pleased to say. We're doing a good job. I'm very pleased at that. It's hard work, and as you can imagine, especially for our regional staff that likes to be out working with their local community constituents, and also our specialists, not the work that they signed up for when they came on board, but everyone is bearing up well. It's a job to do. We know we have to do it, and we're getting good help.
Stephanie, two quick questions. One relating to the one Delaney just a moment ago, that if he's increasing his staff and increasing the number of waivers, and that's increasing the number of, or let's just say the workload of the Department of Justice, how are you doing for personnel to handle that increased number of claims moving to your office?
Mr. Chair, as Lane noted, we did also seek additional staff through the e-board process, and have authorization for 6 limited duration attorneys and some additional staff. We have 4 of those attorneys hired at this point. One just started last week. Who is adding to our claims review staff, and then we've got a new trial attorney starting shortly, and we'll be recruiting more as the bulge that Lane referred to moves through the claims and into the litigation process. So as I said before, it's coming hot and heavy, and as it is for DLCD, it's hard work for the attorneys reviewing the claims and the attorneys handling the litigation, and we're moving them through.
I realize you can't predict how long an appellate decision will take, but could you give the committee a ballpark as to, I mean, if the transferability issue stands the way it is and the appellate court backs the circuit court's decision, I mean, we're reviving all those major issues of Measure 37 in the next session of the legislature, because I know the governor has told the Big Look Committee, stay out of Measure 37. So what I'm seeing is that's going to come back to this body of lawmakers. What's your timeline as far as knowing what the appellate court decisions will be? Just a guess, Stephanie, we won't hold you to this. Okay.
Let me start by saying one question that we will be looking at and that we are looking at with respect to these court decisions is whether they're appropriate to ask for expedited consideration in the appellate courts and expedited briefing. Of course, even if the court agrees to do that, we don't have control over how long they take to render a decision. So I think it's about 6 months generally from the time of a circuit court judgment until a case gets argued if it's done quickly. But then after that, it's really hard to say how long the court would take to rule. It could be a couple months. It could be a year.
And my final question on this, on the ability of LCDC to waive the state claims. Now it appears that there will be no appellate decision in that regard. So making sure that I understand, somewhere along the line, somebody will do that, but it could overturn LCDC's ability to do anything on these claims. Is that ultimately?
Mr. Chair, that's right. Okay. What I was saying is that a case that we thought we would be briefing that issue in very shortly no longer has that issue in the case. I think it will come up.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, on that score, I think we've probably talked about this during the session, but it's important to understand that if a court determines that neither LCDC nor any other state agency, because this would apply to all state agencies, have the authority to waive statute, the likely scenario that plays out from that then is not that these claims are invalid, but that they would default to claims for damages, attorney fees, and costs, because that's the alternate remedy that's provided in the measure, that if you don't waive, then you're liable for any reduction in value plus attorney fees and costs. So these claims would still be valid, but our ability to avoid financial liability through the waiver mechanism would be undone and would convert these, I would assume. I've got my lawyer here to my I used to be a lawyer, now I'm a client, and it's really nice. Would shift these claims from waivers to claims for damages, attorney fees, and costs against the state.
And you're presently around $4 billion in total. Is that an accurate?
Well, Mr. Chair, I always do like to qualify that. I wouldn't take that number to the bank.
I hope not.
Yeah, I know. especially to withdraw any of it. That number is a number that it just reflects the claim, the dollar amounts that are asserted in the claims. Some claims have appraisals of varying detail. Some claims come in with a less formal market analysis. Most claims come in with an opinion of the claimant, and really not much else in terms of stating an actual dollar amount. I wouldn't assume that the actual liability of the state is anywhere near that $4 billion, but it's real. And, of course, every claim would also include, if we're not successful in defending it, attorney fees and costs as well, which adds to the fiscal burden.
Now, if somewhere along in the future your authority to waive statutes is overturned, what is the responsibility of the legislature at that point? And is there a responsibility to the legislature?
It's the only body that can waive them.
Correct.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I used to be a member. I'm not. I'll just offer, if you want me just to offer just off the top of my head, I suppose the legislature would have two options that come to mind. One would be to find the funding to pay the compensation to settle these claims. The other, I'm guessing, and this is, again, I want to go on the record, this is conjecture, that the legislature could retroactively authorize waivers that had been previously granted and clarify the authority of state agencies to waive statutes to which they have been delegated some administrative responsibility. That's a good question for legislative counsel, and I'll leave it at that.
Any further questions?
Now that he's a client, he can give direct answers.
Yeah.
Thank you both very, very much
thank
for coming
you.
This morning. We appreciate it. It was tremendously informative. We appreciate you being
Chair.
Here. Thank you.
Members.
Committee, any further business before us that we need to discuss? Look at that. I mean, we said we'd be out of here by noon. I got 45 seconds.
We aim, please.
Yeah. Committee, I will wait to hear from any of you in regards to where we have our final meeting of the interim committee between now and, say, Labor Day. Let me know. If not, then I'll get with Pat, and we'll probably come back here unless there's strong recommendations. So
I hear Paisley's is nice this time.
Paisley's wonderful. Yeah.
Okay. So is Adele. It's the first week in October
is where we're looking. Yes.
Okay.
Great. We will close the information session on ballot measure 37 and the legal status. I thank the committee for being here today, and this
Chair,
meeting of the House Interim Committee on Land Use is adjourned.
Thank you once again for inviting me.